Welcome back to another episode of the Armchair Strategist podcast. In this episode, we're going to speak about the aftermath of 1962, what happened in 1967, and the effect of all these on 1971. Let's get right into it.
I guess like after their incursions in Arunachal Pradesh and Ladakh, they fell back to their sort of like original pre-1962 lines to some degree, right? They did take over some more land, but why did they fall back?
So here's the thing. Firstly, the whole point of the war had been to teach India a lesson. And these are the words of Chou Enlai, the Prime Minister of China. Mm-hmm. The idea was to teach India a lesson. The idea was to prove a point, to use a weaker neighbor as an example for the entire world. Mm-hmm. Now, the Chinese leaders had been personally, they felt a certain animosity towards Jawaharlal Nehru. He had a much bigger international profile than any of them did. He had also, to some extent, supported China in the initial years of their republic. But his forward policy and his increasingly belligerent talk about China in the early 60s, all this infuriated them. They felt it was a personal affront. So the idea here was to teach many different entities a lesson, Nehru, India, and also to show the world, to show America, this is what we are capable of. We fought you 10 years ago, we haven't forgotten how to fight. The thing you have to understand about the Chinese mentality here, the PRC's mentality is protection of the party comes first, and the party sees enemies everywhere. Enemies must constantly be frightened and intimidated.
Right, I see. So the goal was quite political and not territorial. So it was about showing India who was boss in Asia, showing the West that they're strong, and finally probably also showing internal dissidents that they are a great sort of territorial regional power, right? Because this was happening
Absolutely.
Side by side with Mao's so-called Great Leap Forward and all the disasters that came with it.
Exactly. The Great Leap Forward had failed. Like pretty much everything Mao Zedong was attempting in China, the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward. So the point was you had a very large number of unemployed and hungry people on your hands. The internal dissidence in the party is rising. The party has to keep control over the army ultimately, which is ultimately an instrument of the party. And the best way to do it, nothing quiets an army, nothing quiets a country faster than the drums of war. So you went in, you taught this inferior civilization a lesson. This was as much a civilizational battle as anything else. They were spreading the story that the Indians will have to be reformed by contact with superior Chinese civilization. So there were many intangibles here.
Right, got it. And then why did they not just stay, if they made so many advances, why did they not just stay at their claim lines? Why did they fall back from their claim lines?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they occupied Tawang, for example, which they claimed India had occupied in 51, after the British had gone, in fact. So the reason I can think of, officially, of course, they said we are withdrawing so that a proper decision can be taken. The reason I can think of is that as the Cuban Missile Crisis was coming to an end and as India's diplomatic entreaties were, people were beginning to pay heed, the Chinese realized that if they occupied this territory, it was unsustainable. At some point, India was going to come back, and this time they would have diplomatic help. The Americans might arm them, might fund them. And more importantly, their objectives had been accomplished. Now, if you hold on to northern Arunachal, you also have to get train lines there. You also have to run the place.
Right.
They already were having a hard enough time running the places they did have.
So they were basically kind of afraid of a possible Indian counterattack with Western
which would have
help,
taken many forms.
Potentially, which would have taken many forms, and with Western help, kind of similar to what happened in Korea with the Incheon landings, and
pretty much.
Where basically the South Koreans were beaten back, but with Western allies they made a huge comeback and did a pretty brilliant massive counterattack, which further, kind of embroiled China into a military mess. So they were sort of afraid of a protracted war leading into all kinds of uncharted territory.
That's a nice analogy, and I do agree with you. That's probably playing on their minds. considering that many of these troops were, after all, Korean War veterans. So there's no question that the Chinese felt that continuing with this occupation would be unsustainable beyond a point. It may also be that they did not want to feed more mouths when they had to.
Another interesting reason has been brought up from time to time is that if they did stay on their claim lines, which is basically take all of Arunachal Pradesh and keep their advances in Ladakh also, they would have lost the stick to beat India with. And that means that currently they use this a highly ambiguous border from time to time to apply pressure on India. They would have lost this tool to apply pressure on India.
That's a very good point. The whole point of Chinese foreign policy when it comes to border claims is to keep a pot boiling. Once you say we have settled the border, that's a major lever you have lost to that country. Like with the Russians, for example, they kept the pot boiling for 40 years. With Vietnam, they kept the pot boiling for 40 years. But then they realize Russia and Vietnam are the kind of countries that are not going to go quietly. The Russians will absolutely pockmark our border if we don't agree to what they say. The Vietnamese showed in 79 what they could do to the Chinese. With India, on the other hand, it's a different thing. With India, it's not a question of how good the fighting men are. I have no hesitation in saying the average Indian soldier has more esprit de corps, more motivation, or at least as much motivation as your average Han soldier. The problem in India is political will, logistics, and to some extent, even will of the military command.
Right. Sure. Got it. And the general fact that in Russia, in the Soviet Union and Vietnam, they were dealing against a very similar government to theirs, which is a command government, highly centralized communist state with all the resources of the country at its disposal. Whereas with India, they're dealing with a very fractious political entity with very low amount of institutional memory, which is tends to be reactive rather than strategic, and which is
very
generally a lot more chaotic and less focused on strategic outcomes than the Soviet Union and Vietnam even.
You are so right, and there's another factor there. So I mentioned the 67 Nathula and Chola battles, which India won. At least at Nathula, it is a clear-cut victory. More than 300 Chinese
Let's just wrap up with 62 first. So in 62 in Ladakh, the general scenario was that you had good generalship, highly motivated soldiers, found key points to defend, and Ladakh also offers a lot of key points to defend. Right, we have the Shok River and a few other rivers which run parallel to the Chinese ley lines. So those are natural points of defense. And in Northeast Frontier Province, Northeast Frontier Agency, it was a much different scenario where basically we got an apple kick. So 1962 ended, Chinese went back. The next thing that came up, the next incident which happened was 1967. And what happened in 1967?
So in 1967, I have to say at the outset, much of what I know about this have been pieced together over time, and also from Prabal Dal Gupta's excellent book on the subject, because the government very uncharacteristically downplayed its achievement in 67. We all know about the clobbering of Arunachal in 62, but we don't know enough about the victory of Nathula in 67, which is strange. What we can say is that the commander in the area, Major General Sadat Singh, now he was the commander who was a somewhat pugnacious kind of leader. He did not believe in giving up territory easily. So the Chinese began employing the usual tactics, border guards randomly attacking and killing Indian troops. They also had this strange tactic of speaking in Hindi on loudspeakers and telling the Indian soldiers, you have such bad pay, you have such bad conditions, join us, don't fight for your country. So the Indians got loudspeakers and began sending out the same messages in Mandarin Chinese. So a lot of very, and in at least one case, they put up a picture of Mao sitting on the border. The Indian troops dropped their pants and mooned Mao, leading to a diplomatic incident. So all kinds of bizarre tactics were being employed at this point. At one stage, the Chinese finally crossed across and at Nathula. Now, Nathula is in Sikkim. La, as I said earlier, means pass. Now,
and
this is an important pass.
Sikkim, just for background, was recently taken over by India because its king had acceded to India, right, basically.
That's right. So, Sikkim was one of the many Himalayan states that the British had agreements with, like Nepal and Bhutan and so on. So, but unlike other states, when Quebec was occupied, it rattled Sikkim. And they signed an agreement with India to become a protectorate. Unlike Nepal and Bhutan, they were officially protectorates from the beginning. So the situation was different. And by the mid-60s, Sikkim had Indian troops. It had India managing its foreign policy. It was an independent kingdom only in name. Only in name.
Right. Got it. Okay. Carry on. So what happened at Nathula?
So, to cut a long story short, you had a very vicious battle that occurred with the aid of machine guns, with the aid of close combat fighting, bayonets, and so on. So what happened was that, firstly, because of Sajat Singh's leadership and the tenacity of the troops, you had a whole bunch of Jats and Sikhs and other troops over there who were quite aggressive and were itching for a fight with the Chinese. And there was much more motivation there than in case of 62. I can assure you no one was deserting the front line in this case. So what you saw here was a ratio of about 1:5 in the death tolls. The Chinese lost 5 times as many, and they were rattled by what happened in Nathula. So, in fact, the Indians stopped going across and killing them only after the Chinese government threatened to use its air force if India did not stop. And the single biggest factor in our advantage was the artillery. Sajat Singh opened up the artillery. He asked for permission. When it did not come in time, he told the artillery commander, "You go ahead on my discretion." Later on, because the general and the chief of the army staff at that time was not in Delhi, he was away on work somewhere when this broke out, the note reached Indira Gandhi directly. She immediately said, "Yes, use artillery if you have to." But by that time, Sajat Singh had opened up. The artillery just wiped the Chinese out. Just wiped them out. However,
and that,
what do you think happened?
That goes back to the earlier point which we talked about, which is artillery is very important in high-altitude warfare because it allows you to shoot over ridges, over mountaintops, and attack enemy positions very far away, which may be screened otherwise by several valleys.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so,
and
which
are
very
also,
ingenious
I guess,
and
also
very
it's a good cheap alternative to using air power, right? Like it's you can have large
yes,
concentrations of guns. Shells are much cheaper than getting a plane airborne. So it's a natural choice for defensive fighting in high altitude regions.
I completely agree with you. And the only issue in the Himalayas is, as you saw at Rizangla, sometimes you have overhangs, you have intervening features that provide an annoyance.
Right.
But by and large, artillery is very convenient, very cost-effective. But in this case, while it won out the battle, Sajat Singh himself was not treated very well for this. He was posted out to Mizoram, which was widely regarded as a punishment for his act. He won India a battle against the Chinese 5 years after the humiliation of 62, and he was punished for it.
Right. But I would say he bounced back again in
71
from his career point of view. I think he bounced back in 1971. He came back in strength during the Bangladesh war. I think he played a pretty prominent role there.
Well, that might have been the case, but it's hard to take a government seriously when it is scared of victories against China. What kind of message are you sending China? Now, at this time, I didn't see the 67 battle. There was a build-up to it. There's a very strong diplomatic row which occurred before this, where both sets of diplomatic staffs were confined to the embassy building. They were not allowed to leave. You had people entering the compound, throwing stones, throwing flower pots, random crowds. And a couple of Indian diplomats were punched and kicked on their way to the airport, and they were being deported. Through all this, what stands out is that the Indian government remained strong. It said, if you deport one of our persons, we will deport one of yours. And this rattled Beijing. It is a major factor in Beijing's come down that Delhi is prepared to match you eye for eye. Now, the thing about Beijing you have to understand is this is the mentality of a playground bully, not the mentality of a completely rational actor. If you stand up to them, stand toe-to-toe and eye-to-eye with them, they will realize just how much they have to lose. That mentality was true then. It is true today as well.
Got it. So based on the, would you say that based on the experience of the 1967 skirmishes, that China's 1962 war did not have its intended result? So the political aim of China's 1962 war was to basically cow the Indian leadership into submission for the next several decades and essentially prevent us from taking any kind of regional initiative. But however, we see that in 1967, Sagat Singh fought back in Sikkim, and in 71, we liberated Bangladesh in its entirety. And this came just 9 years after 62. So would you say that the 62 war was a failure for the Chinese?
I think 62 was psychologically a massive victory for them because they have created this inferiority complex which generation upon generation of Indians has imbibed. People who were not born in 62, who were not alive then, have imbibed this and act on it. And today, unfortunately, they are influential people in this country, socially. So you are correct that Sagat Singh did the initiative in 67, but there are only individuals. The mindset, by and large, in India is one of fear. And it's not about China's economic clout. It's not about China's military clout. 50 or 60 years ago, the two countries were equal. Even then, we had this mentality of fear towards the Han.
Right.
So it's not
and
about
that,
the...
That also
clout.
Partially comes from the fact that we are such a semi-literate country, right? And it's we have all these irrational fears, basically. Fear of there are other groups which we're also pretty terrified of and which we tend to react against, and the Chinese sort of joined that long list of irrational fears in my opinion. So that has some role to play,
yes.
Right? Like we're not able to think scientifically about this, and instead we sort of hang on to these 40, 50, 60 year old tropes and fears.
Absolutely. It's a traditional Indian feeling that goes back, in fact, well beyond the modern Indian Republic.
Right. And then let's save that for a different day. I think that's an interesting discussion in itself. So 1967 happened, and then in 1971, the Indian leadership was able to act without Chinese intervention during the Bangladesh War of Liberation. And this was clever because they timed it for November, December period when there's heavy snowfall in the Himalayas and the Chinese can't move large numbers of troops around. And that way we were able to kind of win this great victory without any kind of Chinese intervention.
That's it for this episode of the Armchair Strategist podcast. In the next episode, we'll talk about the quiet decades of the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and share with your friends and family members. Thank you.